Okay, a little assignment before we begin. That was awesome. Each of you needs a piece of paper and something to write with. And I want you to write down on this piece of paper six events from your life. You can just give kind of a word or a description there, kind of to identify each one. But let's say six things that are like what I would call threshold experiences, like you are walking through a door, right? Where you look back on your life and you go, okay, when this occurred, there was sort of no going back. Your life changed from that point on. And if you get a couple highs and a couple lows, right, these kind of experiences, as we begin to identify those, a couple of those in your own life. And then if you fly through that, and then you can assign a score to each one of those. If you picture this on a scale from 10 to negative 10, as far as like a ranking in your life of where that fits on the scale, positive versus negative, okay? So for each of those six. And don't overcomplicate it. Just keep it kind of nice and simple, and I'll get set up here. So go. All right. How'd you do? Anybody need more time? A couple more. All right. If you can multitask, I'll talk a little bit as you're kind of finishing up. But what I want to do is this morning give us a few broad strokes. We've been studying through 1 Peter, and start to see the themes beginning to emerge, right? And this is a letter. It's a long letter written, but it's a letter specifically to a specific group of people with a specific intent. And you start to see in Peter's writing the messages that he's trying to get across. And going all the way back to our very beginning, he starts with the idea of the hope of salvation, understanding what God is doing in salvation, the work that is going on. And he lays this as like a primary foundation for the book. And thinking about salvation, salvation becomes one of those sort of Christian buzzwords that we use, that we all have a general sense of what it means, but I think sometimes we lack a real distinct definition. One of my favorites is Paul, where he says in Galatians, he says to them, "My little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you." And that's a pretty specific picture of what is going on in the lives of believers, that sometimes we see salvation as not having to go to hell. Sometimes we see it as maybe getting into heaven, more of a positive slant on that. But we see in Peter that there's a whole lot more going on to this, that you're growing into something. In fact, there's some aspect of salvation that's being guarded until you finally get to the end. It's there protected for you. But this idea of Christ being formed, I think, is a critical piece in this letter. This is the work that's going on, and it's going to make sense out of the next couple themes that he starts to address, the second one being suffering. And that when you're living in this world, you're living there like in exile. These people probably literally were exiles. But as he's writing to them and saying this identity as an exile, realize that what's going on in this state, in the suffering that you experience, is that you're growing into your salvation. He says this, I'll just read these three verses from chapter 1. These are 6-9. It says, "In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you've not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls." So here's suffering. There's an outcome of this. There's a work that's being done. It's tied to glory. right? But there's a purification that needs to take place, that sort of glory would probably freak us all out if it were given to us today. There's a preparation, a sort of purity of heart that's being done so that we can experience heaven in its fullness when we get there. We're being prepared. And so he talks about what I see as a third theme here. They're all starting with S's, but there's nothing else to that but coincidence. But submission, we've been talking about submission. This idea of coming properly under. So as he's talking about surrender and living as exiles, this idea of authority becomes an important thread. And for people that live in a situation where their authorities are not believers, what do you do? So Peter anticipates three of those, like where their hands might go up. What if I have a non-Christian governmental authority? What do I do? Will you submit? What do I do if I'm a slave and I have an un-Christian, non-Christian master? What do I do? Even in that case, you submit. What if I have an unbelieving spouse? And he's saying, in that case, you submit. And these are not like across every, I mean, we can certainly think of times where it's appropriate to rebel against the government, right? But those are extreme cases. And oftentimes what we see is even in the midst of those authorities, God doing a work in our lives. And so Peter is drawing our attention back to that work, back to the salvation. And this brings us, I think, to our passage today. In understanding what God is doing in the midst of our lives, this is what he's inviting each of these. This is the churches in Turkey. We've been talking about that over the last few weeks. That even in this, that these people would see God's hand at work in what is going on in their lives, having the eyes to see. And this has become kind of a familiar topic for us over the years, that repentance is connected to our way of seeing. It has this idea of seeing beyond the circumstances. So when Jesus is saying, set your mind on things above, not on things below, there's an aspect of repentance that involves that kind of seeing beyond, understanding what God is doing. And so when we talk about these thresholds that you've identified on your paper, these are generally speaking going to be ways where your vision grew through something positive or through something negative in your life. And we're going to identify those as we go. I was telling the Guatemala team that's sending like 40 kids and 10 leaders off overseas for a missions trip and saying to them as they left, your vision is going to change just in entering into something new. You're going to go down and you're going to see things you've never seen before. And God, you're going to see God's hand at work in ways that you've never seen before. To get out of like the normalcy and the complacency, all of a sudden we see it. But what's really exciting is that when you return and you fly back home, all of a sudden home looks different now because of what you've experienced. And this is this idea of a threshold. It's a leaving and it's a returning. And it's going to become an important part of what we're talking about here today. As far as seeing goes, I want to identify two ways that we begin to sort of see these patterns in our lives, because I think this is important. Jesus was talking about this idea of reading the weather, saying, you know how to read the weather. Why don't you know how to read the signs of the times? That we live in a world, Habakkuk talks about, we live in a world that is filled with the knowledge of the glory of God. And expanding our vision is really gaining the ability to see in many ways what is right before our eyes. So two things about nature that I want to identify here as we start. The first is this idea of seasons. There's a beautiful section that's written in the book of Ecclesiastes on this, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. You're familiar with this passage? A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. And in this, you get this sense of the cycle of life. We were just experiencing this with Patty's grandfather passing. and the beauty of a life well lived. And what does that look like? What does that mean? How do we even interpret a life well lived? But you see these seasons that come and close. And our world gives us a beautiful model of that. We see, you know, this, if we take this as a year, and here you've got your summertime, and here you've got your fall, and your winter, and your spring over here, this kind of rotation that is going on year after year after year in our lives. And as our lives go on, identifying these sort of seasons. And we've talked about this before. If you extend this to add a variable of time to this, it ends up looking like this, right? That life goes through this pattern. And it's an interesting thing. If you take your points and you plot them on your timeline, do that for just a second. Draw a line there and put those points. Now you've got these, like, here is the positive scale. Here's a 10 and here's a negative 10. And you start putting these points. For me, here's like my sixth grade. I was the king of fun day. And here's like in seventh grade when I moved away and was at the mountains living up in Crestline, and I ate lunch by myself every single day. Right? And you start like seeing these patterns emerging in our own lives of these highs and lows, these peaks and these valleys. And this is important for us to look at, because this is how our story starts to emerge, which, if we're understanding right, if we're supposed to look at this life as if it's filled with the knowledge of the glory of God, as Peter starts telling us, hey, God is up to something here, even in the suffering, then we're going to see it in this, right? And we've talked about this, that this is going to become like the formula for the abundant life. We've called it before, it's referred to as the Paschal mystery. But this is Jesus' life, his birth, his death, and his resurrection, right? And so when we are talking about growing in our spiritual life, the other thing that I think we glean from nature, other than seasons, is this idea of life and death. In John, Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it. Whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. So as we're talking about submission and we're talking about suffering, this is what Peter is describing, right? He's describing a life that is yielded. In fact, he talks in our last section about how this is creating in us a gentle and quiet spirit, which, can you imagine if you're like friends with Peter, you chuckle to hear Peter talking about a gentle and quiet spirit, right? A heart that is surrendered and submissive. This was very hard for Peter. He wanted to pull out his sword and say, Jesus, step aside. I'm going to take care of business here. And so Peter had to learn this. The death to self comes through three denials of Christ, right? This is part of Peter's death. And sitting there on the beach with Jesus as he's saying to him, do you love me, Peter? Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. And there you see the death to self and the rising to new life, that something is dying here, something that needs to die, that this false self, this self that wants control, this self that wants to control our spiritual growth, that wants to protect and identify its value based on what it brings to the equation. I want to run through something really quick, and we'll see if it's helpful. And if not, I'm going to ditch it for the second service, so sorry. But I was looking at this, and I thought this was really cool. These stages of spiritual development, and I heard about this from a guy, Richard Rohr, but it's not his. Teresa of Avila talks about like the castle, the interior castle. But the first one, let's just stop there for a second. The first stage of spiritual development, which I don't even know if you should call it a one, maybe a zero, but is I am my body. And what that means is, this is like, think of every rap song in the world. This is basically saying, I am my physical self, and it has to do with the way that I look. It has to do with how much money I have, what kind of job I have, right? Anything that's outward appearance. This is stage one of spiritual development. When you go to the magazine rack at the checkout counter and you see all the celebrity magazines, it is all about the spiritual stage one. This is who I am, my beauty, my power. The second stage, I am my behavior, takes this a step further. It's looking to make a good impression. It starts to get some maturity to it. It's still connected to visual acceptability. But this is a little bit more like my actions are who I am, that if I give money to charity or I'm benevolent or these are the things that I do, this is what makes me a good person. So stage two, you start like modifying your behavior. I think of like, if you're, no offense if you're a Dr. Laura fan, but Dr. Laura is kind of this way. It doesn't matter what you want in your heart, it just matters what you do. That makes you a hero to Dr. Laura. At least the one episode I heard. Sorry, Kelly, I know, loves Dr. Laura. So, okay, and I'm not critiquing here. I'm just saying this idea of managing behavior. It's another step further. Number three, I am my thoughts and feelings. And this is pushing more into the realm of education. And you can see spiritually, there's a whole kind of Christian versus secular version of these things. But this is where we want to get educated, right? So we want to learn something, so we go read a book on it. Is anybody guilty of this? My whole office is just filled with books, right? Well, I'm just going to figure this out, so let me read something on it. And we start to progress into kind of our mind becoming aware of who we are, getting in touch with our feelings and our emotions. Step four, this is when we start becoming a little more contemplative, right? We start looking into like our intuitive selves. And honestly, a lot of people don't reach this stage. I think a lot of times we get stuck early on. I think this is what Jesus is saying when like, what good is it to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? Right? There's a dying that is taking place, and it's hard to see at first. But a dying to self and a giving up. And so in stage four is this awareness that like, there is something else going on here. There's a flow, something that God is doing, right? You begin to become aware of the fact that you're being led, that there's a shepherd that's guiding things. And then stage five, there's nine of these, but we'll stop here for now, the dark night of the soul. And there's a reason why we spiritually plateau. Because as we go further and further in, what we are losing is control, right? And as we grow, generally, there's less and less recognition that comes with it. That as we're dying, and as this sense of ourself, the small self, the false self, is losing its grips, there's a releasing that's going on. This is this idea, Peter says it, you're growing into your salvation, right? So in the death to self, this is something where it's saying, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, and you start realizing it is God at work in you to will and work to his good pleasure. So here's God taking us further and further and further in. Now, if this is confusing, I'm sorry, but I like kind of the idea of seeing the progression. As it goes further in, they get less and less appealing, right? My powerlessness, do I really want to come to terms with that? Do I want to realize that, gosh, that the problem out there is in here, right? That what I bring to the equation is just simply my own brokenness, that I come in just as much as everybody else needing God's grace and grace alone. And so you see how God is weaning us off the self. In our passage for today, we're going to look at verses 13 through 22 of chapter 3. It's a little out of order. Mark kindly agreed to switch weeks with me. So Mark's going to be preaching next week, and so we'll get the verses preceding this next week. So sorry about that. But let me read these verses for us. 1 Peter 3, 13 through 22. It says, "Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey, when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, and powers having been subjected to him." Okay, the word of the Lord. Here we have Peter, and again, like revisiting some of our themes, and we're going to unpack this a little bit as we go. Paul writes in such a nice logical progression. He builds this nice case. Peter, I think, may have been ADD. He has a tendency to, like, follow these digressions, right? Which is, it's cool. You know, the scripture is written where the authorship remains intact and the style and their personality, and you see him going, do this because it's like Jesus. And that's like when Jesus descended into hell, which is like Noah, which is like baptism. And you go, okay, we kind of ping pong around and it all fits. There's a flow to this, but we'll follow it through. And I think that this might help us unlock some of what is going on as we see the consistent themes that are going on. In verse 13, this may be enough to have just preached the whole sermon on this verse. It says, "Now, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good?" And I think probably what Peter's saying there is 90% of the suffering that you face in this world you could avoid if you would just pursue good, right? What is the formula? Here's an idea. Just pursue good. It's like saying, you know, the way we, I think, so often are feeling like the suffering that we undergo is somehow unjust when you can just link it right back to something you said, something that you did, something that could have been avoided. And this is very true. I think we would all admit that a lot of the suffering in our life is from things that we've done to ourselves or to others that we're suffering the repercussions of. And Peter, I think, makes it clear that's not what we're talking about here when we're talking about suffering righteously. That's just like paying for the cost of your mistakes. We say this every year at Lent, that Lent is not a time to give up sin, that you're supposed to do that every day, right? That the idea of giving up vice, the idea of putting aside the things that are harmful, that is what we do as Christians. That's what we need to be committed to, you know, to pursue the good, though. There's some great vision in that statement. Be zealous for it. Chase after it. Even defend it as part of the definition there in the Greek. And to know the good and pursue the good, I think, is a huge part of what we are seeking to do as believers. And you know it's good when you take a bite out of it and go, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good, right? We know this almost intuitively. There's a texture to the good. Paul tells us, question everything, cling to the good. And Paul and Peter are kind of saying the same thing here. Pursue it. You know what that tastes like. Pursue it. And sometimes I think we want a little bit of bad with the good, like a little bit of salt. And this is where we get ourselves in trouble. The effect of that, it takes its toll on our spirit, on our soul, on our heart, which is why we're told to protect it, to guard that heart. It's the source. It's the source of the words that we speak come from the heart. I think of that song. Did any of you guys go to Vacation Bible School when you were a kid and sing, "Be careful, little eyes, what you see"? Right? That idea of what you take in and how that affects the heart and how that affects what comes out. Be careful, little hands, what you do. It's a sweet little song, but sometimes I think that this verse just captures the simplicity of how the life is to be lived. What are we setting our minds on? What are we bringing before our eyes? What are we grabbing with our hands to release those things? And with that, we release, I think, so much of the suffering of life. But then he shifts this idea of suffering for righteousness' sake. And he's saying, you will be blessed. You will be blessed if you suffer for righteousness' sake. And I think this is what he means, that as you're descending down to these things, he's saying, look, in this is freedom. In this, you are being set free from the self. Set free from your own, like, self-absorption, your own need to look a certain way, to be viewed a certain way, to be thought of as a certain way. And so I think this descent down spiritually becomes a way into a sort of self-forgetfulness. And interestingly enough, people have said when we are happiest is when we are in that state of self-forgetfulness. I was watching my kids at the beach yesterday, and they were just the world. They were oblivious to everything, just playing with each other and looking at that, and you see the joy that comes in those moments of self-forgetfulness. And I was mentioning that to Patty, and she's like, gosh, am I ever self-forgetful? And it's hard for us. It's a struggle for us, but you see how God is breaking us off of that. And through suffering, refining our hearts, he begins to show us this pattern of himself. And this comes to mind because I've been, for a class I'm taking, writing an autobiography. It's one of the assignments. And one of the things that you're supposed to identify is the redemptive turn. What happens that brings you back? What did you learn right here? I would say for my life that my understanding of myself, my understanding of God, my understanding of my calling almost always comes from this turn, this redemption, this God taking something broken and fixing it. And you may look at those points on your list and think, I still don't have a clue what God was doing there. And sometimes I think it might take us a really long time. But some of these, whether they're self-inflicted or not, God takes and turns. This is like the business that he's in, is redemption. We talked about this in the Bible study last week, that God could have made a world that couldn't break. He could have. He made a world that could break and then came and fixed it. And the reason for that is I think it's a more beautiful story. It's a deeper story. And that what God is drawing us into is not just some sort of meaningful life, but into relationship. And as we start descending down on that list, as our hearts become more pure, then like Jesus said, we begin more and more to see God. We see the hand of a shepherd, and he's a good shepherd. And we see that when we hit this low point, as we look back and we identify the patterns and see what God has done, what it does in our lives is begins to give us hope. And Peter is going to say, you want to know how to evangelize? Just show people that. Just show people that. Instead of the hard sell or the guilt pitch, if you were driving and you got in a car accident today, now there's a place for that message, right? What would you say to God? There's a place for that message, but Peter is modeling something very different here in an evangelism style. That seems to come from like this quiet hope. And to say, you want to offer something compelling to the world, offer them that. And they'll ask you. Where do you get that hope? Where do you get that hope in the midst of those low points? Well, let me tell you what God has done before. Or let me tell you what God has done in the life of my friend. This becomes the power of testimony. And it's unarguable. But people are starving for that. That's the kind of thing that breaks people from these level one down. You know, like it rocks something, because ultimately in the end, the self always leaves us empty. It's why there is addiction. This law of diminishing returns. It never gives what it promises to give. I love this in Romans 15. Paul writes, I will not venture to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me to bring the Gentiles to obedience, by word and deed, by the power of signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God. He says that so that from Jerusalem all around to Illyricum, I have fulfilled the ministry of the gospel of Christ. And you see this for Paul. He just said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go around and tell people what God has done. I think that what we see in this section too that is kind of cool is the power of a good conscience. This is one of the things that's being offered when he says, when you suffer for righteousness and you're undergoing this process of refinement, like gold and the dross being removed, what comes from that is a good conscience. I was thinking about the opposite of that. When you've told a lie and you're afraid of being caught in a lie, has that happened to anybody here? Just me. How horrible that is. And all you, in any like weird look you get from somebody, you're thinking, do they know? Do they know about what I said or what I did? And you never, when you sin, think about, what is this going to do to my conscience? You're just thinking about consequences. What if I got caught, you know? But it's almost worse, like that can drive you mad. One of my favorite books is Crime and Punishment. I love that. How the main character in that book, Raskolnikov, he commits a crime trying to rise above morality, and it drives him insane. Where the police officer in that doesn't even have to, he's like begging to confess his crime at the end because of what the damage has occurred to his conscience. But on the other side of that, the peace that comes from a clear conscience, the confidence that comes. And ultimately here, trusting that God will vindicate. And if there's blame, being able to stand in that with peace, knowing the accusation is false. And this is what God is doing again, is he's refining our hearts as he's taking us deeper and deeper in. We begin to see him, that we're being led into this sort of peace. This is the hopefulness. This is the strength. And this is why it's meekness and not weakness, that as that comes into submission, it's not fighting to defend itself, but it trusts God fully with that. We don't have to defend our honor, we just honor God. We don't have to defend ourselves. We allow God to defend us. So just for a sec, look at your papers and see that redemptive turn. Is it true? Have you experienced that in your own life? Have you experienced God take something damaging and fix it so that it's bigger than it was? And this is the beauty. My favorite guy, C.S. Lewis, says God takes that and exploits it for the good. This is how those bad things remain bad, and yet God's reality is greater, that it supersedes, that it overrules. So whatever that thing is, it doesn't ultimately make it a good thing. If that's like a bad health diagnosis, or that's some sort of trauma that you experienced, something horrible maybe that was done, or maybe it's just that you got ripped off, or God took something from you, or it feels like, God, why did you take that? And you see God saying, trust me, I'll make all this new. That I'm holding this securely for you, that your salvation is secure, and that the work that is going on, it says there in our last section, is forming in you a quiet spirit that God finds precious. Peter tells us that this is what Jesus models. He says in verse 18, Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh and alive in the spirit. That's this, put to death in the flesh and alive in the spirit. And that's this for us as we go through these deaths. As that fleshly side of us, this isn't just our physical bodies that's saying, that's for, I think we might say the ego, but Paul would say the flesh, this false self, as that dies, there's a coming alive that's happening here. All right, so I'm going to run through Peter's digressions real quick because they're interesting. If you ever wonder where, you know, this idea from our creed where Jesus descended into hell for 3 days comes from, there it is. That Jesus went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. I won't go terribly far on that because I don't quite understand it. I think it's interesting. It certainly raises some questions about hell, but certainly God's response to that. I would say this, and this is probably opening a can of worms, but I would say that hell being some sort of like end to God's mercy and love, that's false. That God, like, well, sorry, buddy, you crossed the line and now you're going to pay. I don't think that that is hell at all. I do think that there's a reality to that where God at some point says, so be it. Like Lewis would say, either we say to God, thy will be done, or he says to us, thy will be done. There's this awesome passage in the book of John where Jesus is at this feast where the water is being brought in from the well to the temple, and Jesus stands out there and he says, if anybody's thirsty, come and drink. Come and drink. I'm the fulfillment of this prophecy. If anyone's thirsty, come and drink. And you get this sense of like people, just the crowds passing by, not giving him a second glance. And John says, there's a reason. Isaiah said it was going to be this way. This was prophesied. This had to occur. And yet then it snaps back and there's Jesus in the midst of this, like almost standing against the prophecies and saying, if anybody is thirsty, please come and drink. And that idea of what is God's heart towards the lost, I think it's that. That God's mercy goes beyond, that there are limits to a human will and from where it can bend back, that becomes the limiting factor, but not the merciful heart of God. So if he's down there, there's a great, this is just extra, but from The Way to Glory, there's this bus driver that descends down into hell to take people up to heaven. And some people think that that's Jesus, that Lewis wrote that in the book, or The Great Divorce. Yeah. He takes a bus down there, and these guys are getting on the bus, and the bus driver's like trying to cover his face because it's shining so bright. And these guys getting on the bus are like, who does this guy think he is, right? And the picture of the mercy of Jesus, the submission of Jesus represented there. I think that's what Peter's getting at, that Jesus descends so low. So if you want an example of how far down to go, you just think of Christ and what he models, that he's gone further than anyone ever will go, that he's paid more than anyone ever can pay, that all of us can only bear our own pain and our own suffering. There's only one person who's borne the suffering of all, and that's Christ. He becomes the model. So when Paul says, I'm ready for Christ to be formed in you, I'm yearning for that, you go, do I want that? And you see what holds us back. Self-preservation. But God again and again saying, trust me. Trust me. There's freedom. There's peace. Clear conscience. And ultimately in the end, there's glory. This clear conscience is like integrity. And integrity like structural integrity. Right, John? Where's John? I saw him earlier. We were talking about this. And Baba, there you are. Structural integrity like a beam, right? That's solid. If that beam lacks integrity, just one little spot in that beam can snap, right? So God refining our hearts, he's getting rid of all that junk so that there's a strength, a purity. And he's saying Jesus is raised to this position of authority, like he finishes there, over angels and authorities and powers being subjected to him. But there's a trustworthiness in a heart that has been tried, that we are being made to experience glory in such a way that we can radiate it without clinging to any of it for ourselves. This is the freedom that God is inviting us to. Run down those next sets. I think you have to do it again. Yep, sorry. Boom, boom, boom. The dark night of the soul. I am empty and powerless. Next one. Who I am is more than I thought. Next one. I and the Father are one. Next one. I am who I am, the true self. This idea of what God is doing, that this is being formed in us to be that child, to be who he made us to be. And I love the vision behind that. Again, you have to realize progressing down, you get less and less credit as you go down. But see, in here you start realizing that it's not just a good shepherd leading you, that you have the intimate companionship of Christ. And so the Father's approval becomes all you long for. And Jesus is the perfect model of this. And you see somebody who had just completely subjected himself to the will of the Father, to where that became the initiation of any of the miracles, any of his actions, always were initiated by prayer and by Jesus going before the Father and saying, is now the time? And this is the work, this is the vision that's held up for us. You want to die, why? Because freedom, clear conscience, peace, glory, becoming like Christ. But ultimately, in the end, this is what you're made for, right? This is who you are. That when you stand in heaven, that this is a work that will finally be finished there. And to realize this, you don't get to like jump ahead and skip ahead, that each of you are being led in this. And that's a beautiful thing, that wherever we're at today, we just go, okay, God, today, what do I do today? How do I lean into what you're doing in my life today? How do I be obedient? I've been reading a book with some friends called An Unhurried Life, and the author of it, Alan Fadley, and he used to go to this church. You know, he's talking about, you know, we go to the checkout counter and we're always trying to maximize our time. So we're like seeing, okay, how many people in each line? And oh, that guy's got a lot of stuff and that guy's only got a few items. And then we were talking about this and Tom Berry was saying, or Steve Hester, what it was saying, yes, Steve, you're saying, you keep track of that person in line to make sure that you won in the checkout counter. Which I'm like, I've never done that, so I don't know what you're talking about. But the hurry and the busyness and the clutter and God saying, I want you to live this life where you're just being led, right? Submission, that there's a peace, there's a strength in this to release, to say, okay, God, what are we doing today? I had a day like this the other day where I had not nearly enough time and I was looking at this saying, okay, God, I feel like you put all these things on my plate. And I wish I started every day praying like this. I just went, but it was like more than I could manage. And so I finally was like, okay, you got to help me. You feel like God's going like, okay, finally, Jeff. And watching that day unfold, it was amazing. Brilliant. Brilliant. The things outside of my control that fell right into place. Even options that were better than hoped for. I was meeting with these people and talking about a situation that had opened up, and they were like, how did this happen? And I was like, oh, it gets better. Like, it was just awesome to watch things unfold. And I don't know if every day is like that, but I think God was more going like, remember this, Jeff. This life of submission is the good life. It's the abundant life. It's the life of peace and of happiness and of ease We've kicked aside that yoke of slavery of the self. We're just allowed to move. I want to close with one of my favorite, well, okay. No, I've got two quotes. Sorry, the next one, this is from Michael Scott, where he says, when I retire, I don't want to just disappear to an island somewhere. I want to be like the guy who gives everything back. I want to be like, hey, who donated that hospital wing that is saving so many lives? Well, I don't know. It was anonymous. Well, guess what? That was Michael Scott. But it was anonymous. How do you know? Because I'm him. The false self. Sounds so good. These little fantasies, I love that, just how honest it is. All right, next one. This is a quote I've put up here before, but it's one of my all-time favorites. This is from Mere Christianity. And it's too small of a font, I apologize, but maybe you can follow along if I read it. He says, already the new men and women are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I've admitted, are still hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their voices and faces are different from ours, stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people, which you have formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think you're being kind to them when they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You'll wonder where it comes from. When you have recognized one of them, you will recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, and even creed. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at the very lowest, it must be great fun. I love that. I love that last line. And certainly it goes so deep. But do you have that vision for your own life? Do you see that God is doing that in every single life here? And do you have the eyes to see the knowledge of the glory of God? I pray for us as a church that we would be willing to be led there. And we would trust him. Let me pray. God, thank you for this time. Thank you so much for each one here, God. Pray for hearts that would be yielded, soft and quiet, and given to you, wholly and completely, in Jesus' name.